Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. I know I said we were going to take this week off, but, well, surprise. At the very last minute, I got the chance to grab John Patrick Shanley, the Oscar-winning screenwriter of Moonstruck, and the writer-director of Joe vs. the Volcano, which Sam Bain brought to this podcast just 2 weeks ago. His new film, Wild Mountain Time, stars Emily Blunt and Jamie Dornan as neighboring Irish farmers who spend their days not quite connecting, despite their obvious feelings for one another. It's available on VOD right now. John wanted to talk about Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Celine Sciamma's rapturous study of women in love in a hostile environment. The women are Marianne and Heloise, played by Noémie Merlant and Adèle Haenel. The environment is an island near Brittany in the late 1700s, and their love is a thing that blossoms because they fully see one another. Marianne has been hired to paint Heloise's portrait in secret by Heloise's imperious future mother-in-law as both a wedding gift and a reminder of the young woman's place in rigid European society. But the more time they spend together, the more they connect, and the more tempestuous and richer their lives become as a result. You've seen this, right? It's a masterpiece. This is someone else's movie.
You know, I watched the film. Actually, I have, you know, one of those enormous television sets. I got the Blu-ray of it. And so I watched it at home. It was cinematography, jaw-droppingly good. Just stunning-looking film from the first frame. And I like the austerity of the silence around the characters that the director did not choose to heavily score the film. But in fact, only much later in the story, when it organically sort of erupts from the story, does this, completely instinctually correct music enter the story in the persons of these women around a fire who start singing and chanting. But it's all the more powerful because there had been nothing like it before that. But there was something else going on that has never happened to me before, and I doubt it will happen to me again. And that was that as the film progressed, I started to have this eerie feeling you started to see the paintings. I started looking from the monitor to the walls of my apartment because Helena Delmer, who's the painter that was employed both as the on-camera hand that's painting and whose paintings were used, I have about 9 of her paintings in my apartment. And she was not well known. And I had seen one of her paintings on the internet and was struck by it enough where I found a way to reach out to her and ask her if I might purchase it. And she said, no, actually, I'm about to have a show in Paris, and I need that as well as other paintings that I'm doing. So I have nothing for sale right now. Perfectly French response, you know, just. And so I contacted a friend of mine who was a broker, and he was able to be an intermediary. And I bought, I think, about 9 of her paintings, which are all over my apartment. And so I'm watching this film, and the paintings in the film and the paintings on my wall start talking to each other. And I'm having this 3D experience where the movie is spilling out of the rectangle and becoming something that surrounds me. And I've just never had the experience before.
It's wonderful.
So that was spectacularly strange thing to have happen. And then the screenplay of the film was a very simple premise, beautifully done, that echoed. It was about this idea of painting, this theme of painting, and of how do you understand another person by looking, that's certainly, you know, something that I've done a lot of, and I think that most people in some way have. But it spoke to me. And I found it to be just a thrilling work of cinema.
I can't say that I had a similar experience with it. That's remarkable. And I'm just realizing there's exactly one poster here in my studio, and it's it's nowhere near the screen, so they can't argue with each other. That's just my own visual focus, I think. Mm-hmm. But the sense of living in a space or having the space reach out to commune with you, I guess, for lack of a better term, is something that I've experienced in theaters a number of times, where you just suddenly realize everybody's breathing the movie. Everybody's sort of feeling that happening to them as it goes. And the thing that hooked me with Portrait of a Lady on Fire was slowly realizing that she was switching back and forth between handheld and lockdown cameras to, how can I put this? I used to be thrown by handheld work in a period piece because it just felt... Mm-hmm. It felt wrong somehow, and that's just my own expectations. I saw a Romanian film once that was shot digitally in the relatively early days of digital cinema, and it was set in the 50s, and people were running around with handheld cameras to shoot this movie, and it just felt obscene somehow.
I understand that.
But here, the choices work for the immediacy and the urgency and the hostility. I mean, it feels there are shots in the first hour where it feels like putting the camera down would be dangerous, where you know the waves would take it or the wind would knock it over. And that just psychologically puts you in this space of agitation. And we have seen how difficult everything is for these two people, even before they acknowledge each other as partners, as potential intimates, not even just in terms of lovers, but just as friends. It's like the barriers to everything that happens seem to be communicated through Siama's choices of cinematography. And I'm going to butcher her name, I fear, but Claire Maton's work is just so raw and immediate and polished and beautiful, just as the moment demands, and somehow all at once. And that alone sort of grabbed me by the face and pulled me into the movie. Mm-hmm. But I can only imagine what it would be like to watch the film and see its vision, its literal vision reflected around you.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, that the parts where there is like two people seated speaking to each other and nobody moves.
Yeah.
For a protracted period of time. And then first I'm going like, why is she doing this? And then I'm like, It's a painting. You're like watching a painting talk. And once I started to see it that way, it was very compelling, very beautiful.
Yeah. And it also underscores the emotions, right? Because if no one's moving, then all you can do is look at them more closely, and you see the tensions, and you see muscles straining and people so close to each other and not moving to touch each other. And then it's as though the film is about to explode over and over and over again. And when it finally does, it's just, it's thrilling. I keep saying exhilarating in regards to this movie. And it was a hard sell to people before it opened, before people could really get a sense of what it was. It's just, well, it's a love story, but it's also about the female gaze. It's about being seen by a female gaze. It's about, it's about understanding, right? I mean, and Siama's been making these movies all along that are about gender roles and fluidity and agency and sexism and privilege, but setting it in the 17th century is such a 16th, late 16th?
18th.
Oh, right, 1784. Thank you. I'm terrible with that.
That's I'm not that good either.
My biggest flaw. But by making this a film set in a time where the options, it's not that they were limited, they didn't exist for women to have this sort of agency and direction. And that there's one man in the film, we see him at the very beginning, and he's pretty much useless. He leaves her, he strands her in this world. And then it's just their world. And without the male gaze anywhere, without any judgment from exterior sources, they can find each other. And it's just, how do you convey that in a 2.5 minute trailer? How do you explain to people that that's what this is about?
I'm fortunate that I never saw the trailer. So I didn't have to face that. Although I think if I saw two minutes of that cinematography, I would have wanted to see the film. I could. It is so luminous throughout. And I also felt that the film was very much in a conversation with the piano. That is invoked multiple times during the film, maybe most especially in the scene with the piano unveiled, that, you know, they put their hands underneath the covering cloth, and that becomes a quietly, incredibly erotic moment. Maybe, you know, echoing a bit the Harvey Keitel moment in the piano, but also when she jumps in at the beginning after when the canvases fall in the water, and her standing looking at the ocean and that period, it kept bringing it up. And I sort of felt it was, in one way, the director saying, what would happen if you made the piano without a man? how would it change this? It would be more to my liking. That in fact, he may have been a discordant element from something that might have gently gone deeper had he not been present.
Yeah, I hadn't even considered that interpretation, but there's been so much of a fad. I guess it's not a fad, but we're currently in this time where the gender flip is the most important thing you can do to a property. Since everybody's remaking everything, we might as well reorganize the perspectives and see how that plays. But removing elements, especially from something like that, yeah. I mean, I wonder how Campion would play if she had the opportunity to revisit that material, that specific film. It's come up on the podcast that we did an episode on it, and I remember revisiting it and realizing that there's just so much. It's not that there's so much more going on now in 2019, whenever it was we did it. It was that when I saw it in 1993, I was just like 25 and I was in no place to understand everything that was going on. I missed so much. And I'm twice that age now, and I got to see Portrait of a Lady on Fire as a fully formed person, I suppose, with somebody who can just read the love and the emotion and the desire. And it's all just so clear. The lines that Siama draws are so clear. And it's not to say that the piano is murky. I don't want to dismiss that film at all. But to watch this movie now after a decade of seeing Siama's other films and kind of getting to appreciate what it is that she does, this seemed like a really odd choice for her. And yet it feels like the culmination of everything she's been working towards. It's just...
And look at the title. Portrait of a Lady is a previously existing work that Jane Campion adapted.
Yep.
In that one, the discordant element, again, John Malkovich, sort of tips over the tea service, and it becomes a different kind of story. What would happen if you subtracted John Malkovich and added a woman?
Yeah. I mean, here we have Valeria Golino as the authority and sort of embodying male force, because she is doing the things that tradition dictates. Right? She's operating from a very patriarchal position, even though she's ostensibly the matriarch. And there is this sense in her performance, too, of someone who has deliberately refused to pursue her heart, who has seen these opportunities and rejected them. And what astonished me is the way that it just doesn't matter, that she just drifts away from the center of the story because their relationship is just more important. There is nothing she can do. She can interfere, but she's a nuisance to the movie. The narrative of the film is just not interested in her, which I found really almost tragic on second viewing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And, you know, given that most people in North America only really know her from that Pee Wee Herman movie, it's just, she still has this great career. She's just been working elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. She's really kind of a living painting in the film.
Yeah. Galina, oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it, the two things of painting as a way of trapping somebody and painting as a way of freeing somebody. And I feel like Galina's character is trapped by the painting that she's in.
Mm. And that she's built that world for herself. Like, those are the results of her decisions.
That's the accommodation that she's made.
Yeah. And it gives some level of dignity, I suppose, to the women of that era who had no choice, who she represents, that they weren't rendered ugly or cruel, but for their own choices, that the things that they do could be perceived as ugly, but she can justify whatever she's doing because that's the world she exists in.
Well, she was trapped in a painting, and now she's arranging for her daughter to be trapped in a painting.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. She's been fixed in that space ever since.
Somebody else's conception, not her own conception.
Yeah, and she's played, not played into it, she has been bound by that ever since.
Yeah.
And the painting that results from Marianne being hired to see Heloise for the first time properly, as no one else has ever regarded her, is perfect and frustratingly imperfect because it keeps changing. Because the more she understands of her, the more different it becomes, and the more unsuited to simple portraiture this woman is, because there's so much there that can't be contained in two dimensions, except that she does because she's that good an artist. And watching that push and pull, and watching the two of them figure each other out, there's a still frame that popped up, I think it was in the Canadian press kit, of the shot with the lighter of the two of them, and it's Heloise just glancing sideways at Marianne, and there's this little half smile on her face, and it looks like she's about to speak. It's just this image, this still that shouldn't work, but I love it so much because it captures everything about their relationship. These little fascinations, and each of them trying to perform for the other before they really understand they don't have to. And then once they get together, they perform in a different way because they're just comfortable and they can be themselves, and all of these things swirling around. I always wonder what it's like to crack the screenplay when someone is trying to figure out how to tell this story, what the moment is where they realize they can do it.
Mm. Well, I mean, actually, I was just looking at your gesture where you kept doing this.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, there's these two women and they're doing this, affecting each other.
Yeah.
And then the director and camera woman, there's two women behind the camera and in front of the camera. We don't see that often. And they're doing that too. And that sort of completes the quaternity, I think, of how they got to something that was so resonant.
It's just their vision uninterfered with, right? It's the collaboration comes right through. It's, I believe it. And the sense of power that connotes, that you can actually do this now, that the industry exists where this film can exist. It is, you know, we're two white guys talking about this movie. Older white men. It always feels, I mean, we are, but at the same time, it feels like there's an extra space that we should be setting for the creation, for the creators, for the art. And it's a conversation that always happens with cinema, with literature, because the voice, how can I put it? If we're talking, if somebody brings a movie to this podcast, it's generally because they responded to it and it moved them so profoundly that they really want to talk. I mean, my standard line is always just pick something you're willing to talk about for an hour, because that's what we'll do. And inevitably, it's something that people respond to so vividly that it has its own form, that you want to invite the movie to talk about itself as well, or somehow participate. The communication of the art is the thing that I just find so fascinating, that neither of us made it, and yet we both feel like we know it and can talk about it and unpack it. And it still will be there, just as the piano was for me 25 years later. It's going to wait me out. The movie itself won't change.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to one of the producers on the film that I just released, Wild Mountain Time. And, she was expressing some concern about something. And I said, the film is safe from us now. it doesn't matter what we say anymore. It doesn't matter what we do anymore. The film is safe. Yeah. And that's the important thing. We'll die. The film will be the same. Good.
Yeah. It's something that I just, a colleague of mine, John Harkness at Now Magazine, used to say that his favorite movie is Rules of the Game. And every time he watches it, he sympathizes with a different character. He doesn't mean to. It's just that he's in a different place. The film hasn't moved, but he's coming to it from a new direction.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, moments of this reminded me of La Ventura. Just, you know, sort of trapped in a little world of their own, surrounded by the sea. But different. I mean, this had much more, you know, much less Antonioni's kind of circularity, and had much more of a linear thrust, very quiet, but real linear thrust.
Yeah, it's got that sting at the end too, that exquisite little moment of silent acknowledgement that everything that we've seen and all of these experiences have meant something. It isn't just an anecdote that they'll tell friends when they get drunk enough. It's this most profound relationship. That's not something Antonioni ever really did. Mm-hmm. He sort of let that stuff float.
Yeah. It's almost impossible for me to quantify what Antonioni was doing. I know that it was endlessly provocative to me.
Oh yeah. You can lose yourself in those frames too, just the same way. But
he had an incredible eye.
Yeah. But here the sense of hostility, I think. That's the difference to me, is that the trial of getting to the island, the actual effort it takes for them to do anything once they're there, the walks that are so stormy and windswept and still worth having, but you have to, you know, bundle up entirely and wear mesh on your entire body just to survive the spray and the sand. That sense that everything that happens there is more valuable because they've made it happen, that the canvases can be saved and that the painting can exist and then get off the island as well. It's all, you know, it's that castaway fantasy where wouldn't it be great if, but it's just a harsh, awful world that human contact makes bearable.
Yeah, I'm very attracted to castaway fantasies. Very attracted.
Well, Wild Mountain Time is sort of an isolated little world in itself, isn't it? I mean, the island you create is almost an island within the, I mean, obviously literally, but within the world of the film, it's a place that you have to travel to and travel from. And
well, I think every person is a castaway. I think when you visit another human being, it's almost an interplanetary event. I've had many interactions in different environments as a result of just living my life. And some have been in Ireland with my family on the farm that my father was born on, and some have been in the Bronx with the Italian-American community. And each one of them is a separate door that I can go through and visit with at any time. In Ireland, in the country, in the farmland, the isolation of the farmers is deep and real. The loneliness of the farmers is something that journalists write about in Ireland, that it's the plight of many farmers, that they, the ones that didn't marry, end up alone on farms for the rest of their lives. There's a sort of window during which they get married. And if they miss that window, they never do. For reasons that are difficult to fully plumb. The farm that's in my family, run by my cousin Anthony, he never married. And it's a fascinating person who, to American eyes, you go, why didn't this person ever marry? Or the equivalent, why did this person end up alone on this farm when they're so, you know, sociable and passionate and particular? And it's something to do with the culture of Ireland and also the land of Ireland. There is a remoteness that is easily achieved in Ireland. You don't have to go that far to have gone very far.
My closest experience has been whales, but yeah, I get that. I know what you mean.
But the farms are different. The farms are different than the urban. Like Dublin is a different world.
Right.
In the Irish culture, the city people, like in Dublin, they want to deny the existence of the Irish farmers because they feel it's backward. And they want to be thought of as a forward-moving people. And of course, people like me come in and go, but it's the most beautiful part of our, not just physically, but culturally, this is the richest and the deepest part of your land. But that's maybe the role of the outsider, is to see what's obvious that might be, because of short-term concerns, a blindness for people who live there.
Yeah. I think that brings us back to Portrait of a Lady on Fire in a weird way. The thing that Marianne does is see.
Yes.
And we get to see it with her.
Yes. And also that the filmmaker and the screenwriter were drawn to a fantasy of such isolation. Mm. Why? In other words, it's not just that you have a camera and they drop you by parachute into a location, you start shooting. You choose to go there. So something, I think, an idea of purity, an experiment, is what drew her to tell a story in such a secluded environment, because it's a crucible. It allows things to unfold at their own pace and in their own way, and it allows the unspoken to become potent. Whereas if there's a hurly-burly of people and events, that's less possible. I do find it attractive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, Wild Mountain Time originated as a stage play and would have been far more limited in its perspective. But the pub scenes are, I kind of really responded to those, the sense of life happening all around that these characters are isolating themselves from by choice.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the house that I grew up in on Saturday nights, you know, my father would take out the accordion, which was decorated with rhinestones depicting across American and Irish flags and with its mother of pearl buttons. And he would play Irish music and my aunts would get up and dance around the living room and everybody had to sing a song or tell a story or a joke. And it was talent night. And talent night, which I then, when I went off on my own in my 20s, every year I would have a party at Christmas, and I would have a talent night. And if I had one, I had parties sometimes at other times of the year, and I would have a talent night at those too. And people knew it. People prepared to perform when they came. And that went on for, I did that as an adult for probably 10 years. And then that was no longer what was going on in my life. But in this film, I have a little talent show because I'm a big fan of amateurism. Much more than polished professionalism. It was interesting for me to have a performer like Emily Blunt, who actually is an incredibly accomplished singer, and have her sing as if she were a gifted amateur, and to do it singing to Chris Walken's character, reminding him of his wife's favorite song, and by extension, his lost wife, so that his conscience will be awakened to what she would have wanted him to do now. So that she's not simply singing a song, she's playing a scene, and the scene has a result, which is he changes as a result of her singing. And that's what allows, I think, you to have performance in a piece and have it truly be organic, as opposed to something that stops the story.
We've sort of talked about parallels, but obviously Portrait of a Lady on Fire is such a recent film. And the question I usually ask at the end of an episode is if there's anything in it that you yourself would want to borrow or reference or replicate or
everything. I'd like to steal everything, which is the highest compliment, you know? from the actresses to the costume design to the cinematography to the use of organic music within the piece to the screenplay. It's a major piece of cinema and doesn't declare itself so. It allows you to find it so. I'd kill to work with that camera woman. Oh my goodness. She's gifted, really gifted.
Yeah. Well, her work on Atlantique is just, it's completely different, right? I mean, it's got, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's,
no.
It's a Mati Diop's film. It's on Netflix. It's, it's a modern ghost story. It's very difficult to explain, but it's also a romance, and it's also, I think you'd like it. And it looks nothing at all like Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It's remarkable just how different it is.
Yeah. But one of the signs of a terrific camera person.
My thanks to John Patrick Shanley, whose new film Wild Mountain Time is now available to watch on VOD from Elevation Pictures. Thanks also to Olivia Nassner. She knows what she did. You can find John on Twitter at JohnJPShanley, all one word, and you can find Portrait of a Lady on Fire on Blu-ray and DVD in a genuinely gorgeous special edition from the Criterion Collection. It's also available on Apple TV and Google Play, and streaming on Hulu in the US and Crave in Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days. Go check them out. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, SEMcast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're there. One of them must be up this week. Until 2021, stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you have to go out. I'll see you in the new year.